Bonjour Finn Brunton. Donc vous êtes enseignant à l'université de NYU à New York et vous vous intéressez aux relations entre la culture, la société et les technologies de l'information. Et vous venez de publier surtout une histoire du spam qui s'appelle Spam, A Shadow History of the Internet, donc une histoire de l'ombre de l'Internet. Et c'est à ce sujet aujourd'hui qu'on se rencontre donc pour parler du spam. Alors pour la plupart des gens, moi comprise, spam, c'est un mot qui évoque immédiatement ces emails qui vous promettent d'agrandir phénoménalement la taille de votre pénis ou qui vous écrivent de la part d'une personne richissime qui est prête à vous léguer toute sa fortune en échange de vos codes bancaires. En bref, c'est du déchet, c'est quelque chose qu'on jette immédiatement, qu'on met dans le dossier corbeille de sa boîte mail. Et mais vous, vous avez passé 3 ans de votre vie, puisqu'il s'agit de votre travail de thèse, à faire des recherches justement sur le spam. Alors pourquoi? Pourquoi s'intéresser au spam? Pourquoi passer autant de temps sur une question pareille?
When we generally, people on the internet, encounter spam, it's often in the form of this kind of mild, small, strange annoyance, you know, this weird email that we throw away, this strange Facebook post that isn't directed at us, this sort of a web page that we click on that's just strange junk full of advertising, and we tend not to think too much of it. But when you go behind the scenes, you realize that spam is huge, it's vast. In fact, in many areas of the internet, spam is more than everything else that's happening. Spam email, just taking email alone, is about 80 to 90%, depending on the day, of all email that is sent. Spam is the vast majority of what is going on. We just don't see it because our filtering systems manage to catch most of it. But the weight of spam, the weight of this system, it shapes how search engines work, it shapes how email works, it shapes how the internet itself is developing. And it does so largely invisibly because we have built this huge apparatus to make it so we don't have to see it. But it's nonetheless there. And to understand why the internet is the way it is, we must understand how spam works.
Vous donnez une définition du spam comme c'est l'usage des infrastructures, des technologies de l'information pour exploiter des agrégats d'attention humaine. Cette formule est vraiment centrale dans votre étude et avant qu'on se penche de plus près, qu'on plonge vraiment dans l'histoire du spam, est-ce que vous pouvez un peu résumer, nous expliquer comment l'étude du spam permet de comprendre comment Internet est devenu justement un médium qui fonctionne sur cette économie de l'attention?
The underlying structure of this definition that I provide for spam as this method of exploiting these technologically gathered spaces of human attention stems from trying to see how value was generated and circulated on the internet. Spam was something whose dynamics are very hard to completely understand until you start to see how we began to make attention online into something that was a source of revenue. And there's a little bit of a secret in my book. It's something that I didn't have time to really bring out in depth. It was a little bit beyond the scope of the book, but it's something that I hope is kind of present as an invisible part of the argument, which is that if you take the definition that I've provided of what spam is, and you really think about it, it becomes clear that it's actually quite difficult to figure out how advertising doesn't also qualify, doesn't also fit that same definition. And that's partially because that secret, that joke is buried in there, precisely because spam and advertising have always had this unsteady relationship, this very blurred line that lies between the two of them in the history of the internet as a whole. And the reason why that is interesting, the reason why it matters to study that, is because that is not the way it always was. The internet has changed fairly recently into something in which it was seen more as an engine of commerce and as a system for gathering and profiting from attention in much the way that television became. But before that, there was a very different model of what the internet could be, how it could work, what it would be for very different kinds of communion and communication that were not necessarily structured around pooling people's focus together and then putting ads in front of that focus and then making money from those ads. And spam is, as it is a part of these many other sort of aspects of the history of the internet, where it forms this kind of hidden face or secret obverse. Spam, in this case, forms part of the genesis of the internet becoming an advertising medium. And it very much offers a sort of undergirding perspective on how that happened.
Quelles archives avez-vous utilisées pour une histoire du spam, c'est-à-dire une histoire de des choses qu'on jette, qui sont pas pertinentes, qui dérangent, enfin qu'on détruit?
The history of spam is especially fascinating to research precisely because it is the history of things by and large ignored, discarded, thrown away, and so on. And I began to think of it in sort of two respects. And one was that part of what made investigating it so fruitful, part of this revelation of the secret side of the internet, is that spam functioned the way that archaeologists love to find middens, you know, the buried piles of trash that prior peoples have left behind, precisely because in there you often get so much more of a picture of how society actually functioned. If you can begin to look at, you know, at pottery and at currency and at the bones, you can understand what people ate and drank. You get into a much more intimate and particular detail than you do when you're just looking at the temples and the palaces, as it were. Much of the record of spam is in the corpus, like the textual corpus of people trying to build anti-spam filters. And so you don't just get the mass of spam, but you also get their theorizations about how spam works and how to distinguish it from quote-unquote legitimate internet conversation. So suddenly you also have this portrait of how people were thinking through what the internet was for, what should be done with it. So the other entertaining thing about this was that you know, that sort of that wonderful remark of Walter Benjamin's about how every document of civilization is also a document of barbarism. Every document of spam is also a document of the birth of a particular kind of internet criminality. So investigating it became, following it through these archives, became in many ways kind of the disclosure of the invention of crime on the internet, of the discovery of what could be done and what could be gotten away with. So finding these things often involved law enforcement, as that would suggest, but also many of the early discussions about what should be done about spam were all conducted publicly. They were all taking place on these various like sort of chat venues and discussion venues for these different groups. So it turned into, one of them is a million messages long. So going through that million messages turns into this kind of multi-decade study of nothing less than the constitution of internet governance. In matters large and small, technologies are this space of negotiation, and that negotiation, precisely because it so often involves words as well as technical objects, it involves performances as well as it were, performance. Those are dramatic spaces, and so much of the structure of what was happening in the struggle over spam that plays out over 30 years and counting, you know, going forward into the future, so much of this struggle took the form of two kinds of performances, performances of code and performances of language. So people writing software and people making statements, people making assertions. This is what the network is for. This is what it should not be for. This is who should be in charge. This is how we are going to manage who is in charge. All of these methods of doing politics and doing technology simultaneously, that was what is playing out in the course of this drama over the course of the history of the internet.
Qu'est-ce que ça a été le premier spam?
The story of the first spam is an extraordinary story, I think, and one that's also very illuminating about how the network developed and how it changed, how it kind of became what we've started to know now. And it begins with ARPANET, and in some ways even before ARPANET. So what is this ARPANET thing? The ARPA stood for Advanced Research Projects Agency, which was a sort of military scientific research group in the United States, which still exists, although it has now changed its name. They're called DARPA for defense, and now they build terrifying robots and drones and things of that nature. But at this early period, they were working on a variety of different projects to try to make computing resources accessible to this tiny community of military researchers, engineers, and academics. And the process of doing that produced all of these effects that no one was anticipating. And to be clear, this is still a tiny world. These are extraordinarily, you know, well-connected, well-trained, intelligent people, but we're still talking about, at first, just a matter of a few hundred people, and then eventually a few thousand, but nonetheless, this very small group, which created a sort of unique atmosphere in the history of networking. They were developing a system which would, in its essence, eventually sort of permeate the world, but they were developing it in a framework of extraordinary communal trust because they all knew each other. They were all, in a very literal sense, people who went to the same conferences. Almost all of them knew each other face to face. So if you look at these very early days of the ARPANET, for example, you can find a famous document that was circulated by one of the crucial figures in the creation of the ARPANET, someone named John Postel, one of the original network architects. And the document is called On the Junk Mail Problem, and this is in the 1970s. And Postel's answer to the problem of people sending too much traffic over this network is wonderfully straightforward, which is just call the person in charge of the sort of, you know, dysfunctional part of the system and ask them to stop. Because of course you know them, you know, why wouldn't you? Everyone on this network knows each other. So in this space, a couple of things happened which helped to kind of signal the problem that was about to come. The first was on a sort of small network at MIT that became sort of connected into this ARPANET system eventually. And on that small network, and this is in 1971, in the midst of the Vietnam War, in the midst of a huge movement on the part of academic engineers and technologists and researchers to begin to refuse to participate in the process of doing the research that would help to lead to further weapons development for the Vietnam War. On this network of local users around MIT, one of the people who helped to develop the communication system for that network, a programmer named Peter Boss, sent out a message to everyone that said, "There is no way to peace, peace is the way," and launched into this kind of long pacifist document about the importance of conscientious rejection of the responsibilities that were being placed on these engineers. And it's such a perfect example of the kind of this moment where suddenly people who have built a system for many people to exchange messages also begin to realize that they have built a kind of audience, a unique sort of audience, a self-selected audience of exactly the kind of people that you would want to reach if you were a passionately pacifist engineer in the middle of the Vietnam War. But it's also a story that just kind of ends there, because the person actually in charge of the program was, in a physical sense, down the hall from this program, and you could just show up and ask him to knock it off. So by the same token, the uncertain boundaries of what is or is not important for people to see comes into play again a little bit later on as ARPANET has grown in size, become more substantial, when the first commercial spam message is sent, which is an advertising message for a company called the Digital Equipment Corporation, a computer manufacturer that used to be quite significant, which was sent to all of the people who were using ARPANET on the West Coast to let them know that these new computers were shipping out that had built-in support for the connections that you needed to use ARPANET. And on one level, this kind of makes a sort of logical sense. Like, this is essentially the only population in the world who would A, be interested, and B, be in a position to actually buy these new machines, so why shouldn't they be alerted that they're being released? But it created a firestorm. It created an instant debate, an instant huge argument, which is exactly the same argument that has been borne down through the decades to the present day. The argument over, well, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem like what we should be using this system for. It was built with US taxpayer dollars. It was built by us for our own research, which is separate from commerce, which is separate from business. So why on earth are we allowing it to be used for advertising? And then that question is instantly followed by the second question, which is, wait a second, who is we? Who is we to decide this? And how are we supposed to come to this decision and then express that? Who are we to kick people off or tell people what to do? And that debate, that is the moment of the constitution of the internet, even before the internet, as an object of political inquiry.
Est-ce qu'on peut du coup dire que c'est le spam qui a permis aux utilisateurs d'ARPANET de se constituer en communauté d'utilisateurs? Donc communauté, un terme dont on sait l'importance aujourd'hui. Donc est-ce que voilà, est-ce qu'il n'y aurait pas eu de communauté internet sans le spam?
I think that community and spam are fundamentally in a dialectical relationship, and that we can see that very much expressed in the early genesis of spam, and in factors kind of going forward to the present day, that spam is, in my argument, part of the constitutive interference, that moment where something happens that suddenly disrupts the existing arrangement, that forces us to confront ourselves as a community, to suddenly realize that we are no longer just, as it were, abstract nodes on a graph of connections, but instead we are actually something that begins to look like a political event, like a demographic, like a force that has to come to terms with itself.
Passons à l'acte 2 de cette histoire. C'est dans les années 90, Internet s'ouvre aux acteurs privés, commence à devenir un médium commercial. Et comment le spam réagit et répond et reflète cette évolution du médium?
So to understand how spam begins to change as we move into the 1990s, and especially as we kind of move into a really extraordinary period between 1995 and 2003, it's important to understand what commerce meant to the early internet, which is again something that I feel like we have very much forgotten, and which is very important to recover. It's very important to remember the sense of the internet as something that was meant for all, and potentially meant for our use in a very different way than we might think of a kind of this sort of this vast business, this vast shopping mall that it has become in many ways. So early spam was a form of behavior that was often distinguished by the people who were trying to stop it from commercial activity. Some early documents, and this is pre-1995, where people are saying, like, these, we are going to enumerate all the different sins against the network so we can figure out how to stop them one by one. In their list, they would often have, like, commercial activity, advertising, and then a separate category would be spam, which was just seen as, like, excessive noise, you know, misbehavior, writing too much, too often, copying text, filling things with junk, etc., etc. Now, The reason it's amazing to see those things on the same list, because it makes you aware that there was an extended period in which the internet was, both by law as well as by charter and by common consensus, non-commercial. It was going to be a space for conversation, for collective activity, for research that was going to be distinct from, you know, getting and spending and advertising. And then that all begins to transition in the early 1990s and into 1995, which is the moment when there's a formal handoff and control over internet access is passed away from being essentially a government utility into the hands of many private companies. And suddenly commercial activity begins to explode. And it's right around exactly that moment. It's in 1994 when two lawyers send a message on Usenet, which was sort of yet another huge, individual-run non-commercial network that ended up being folded into the internet at a certain point. They send a message to everyone on Usenet, to every active discussion group, advertising their legal services. And it's at this moment that the word spam suddenly leaps from this term for just like, excessive online activity into indiscriminate advertising, because they are trying to get to grips with what these people have done. They're not just pranking everyone. They're not doing some kind of con. They are, in fact, advertising a, admittedly, in retrospect, shady, but nonetheless legitimate application of their services. And they kind of announce the advent of this moment because they do not run away. When the internet community does what it's done in the past, which is to come at them with the charivari, to come at them with social unrest and hate mail and anger and satire and so on, they give interviews to the New York Times. They publish a book about how to market online. They announce the advent of marketing as what the internet is for.
Alors effectivement, à propos de ces deux spammers, vous les citez, écrivant, le cyberspace n'est pas du tout une communauté, c'est-à-dire... Ils disent, en fait, c'est simplement un agrégat d'utilisateurs et c'est ça que nous avons utilisé en envoyant ce message à des milliers de gens. Et ça pointe vers une des définitions les plus intéressantes, je trouve, que vous donnez du spam, c'est-à-dire un dispositif qui joue sur l'ambiguïté constitutive d'Internet, c'est-à-dire qui est à la fois un protocole, une architecture et un imaginaire. Et c'est, selon vous, un des traits distinctifs du spam qu'on retrouve quelles que soient ses incarnations à diverses époques. Alors, est-ce que vous pouvez nous expliquer un petit peu comment ça fonctionne?
Spam functions in exactly this space of uncertainty between how the internet in fact works and how we feel that it works and sort of how we conceive of ourselves in relation to it. As spam begins to really take off in the 1990s and into the early 2000s, as it begins to become a serious business and a serious problem, a major part of what enables it to take off is precisely the disjuncture between the internet in practice and the internet in theory. When Cantor and Siegel, these lawyers who send out this advertising message, when they say the internet is not in fact a community, horrible as it is to say, they are in some sense absolutely right. For more than a decade now, many, many people online had been sort of gathering together and building this extraordinary new network culture, but predicated on a particular sense of themselves as somehow being part of what Bernard Anderson would call an imagined community, in much the same way that we sort of think of ourselves as being part of the family of the human species, you know, and citizens of our nation and so on. But in fact, there was nothing really binding them together. You know, there was never a formal constitutional agreement, there was never a structure of enforcement in place. Instead, it really was just people on computers. And so for the next 8 years or so, you basically just see this kind of monstrous thrash as people online adjust in all kinds of different ways to suddenly realizing that they have a very different relationship with this system that is obviously so important than they thought they did, that they belong to it and it belongs to them in a very different way than they might have assumed at first. It's a moment in which much of the early rhetoric around the internet, which we still live with, is suddenly revealed to be much more complex than it may have at first appeared. And that rhetoric, that sense of our relation to the network, is very much predicated on the idea that it is, and I mean this in a kind of political, even philosophical sense, and not just a technical sense, it is decentralized, it is open access, it is free to all, and so on. That part of the promise of the internet had always been this idea that as long as your computer follows the relevant protocols, anyone can play, anyone can contribute their voice. The gatekeepers are gone. We will all speak freely. We will all speak as equals. We will be disembodied. We will no longer be able to be judged on matters like, you know, gender, race, and class, and so on. And we will finally be free of nation. We are announcing nothing less than the advent of a post-national, global, cosmopolitan space. So that is obviously the somewhat overheated rhetorical sense of self online. And that moment after 1995 is this really quite bruising moment of suddenly realizing this other form of relation exists. And it is the relation of not people, not even citizens, but users. And users who are, in fact, in a very different set of power relationships with their internet service providers, which are now, by and large, private companies, with their national jurisdictions, with the countries that actually, that both they live in and that also own the equipment that they are interacting on, and with increasingly the sort of services and platforms like Google and Facebook that they are transacting on. So in some sense, who are you on Google? Well, you are at once, you're actually, an even better example would be, who are you on Facebook? You are at once yourself, you are a performance of yourself, you are kind of your identity, and you are sort of addressing the world, as we can see in the case of things like the uprisings all over the world that have taken advantage of Facebook to present themselves. But you are also a wholly owned set of data that can be analyzed, that lives on a bank of servers in Santa Clara, California, subject to all relevant laws and jurisdictional issues, and owned by a company that doesn't particularly care about our sort of sense of ourselves as being these cosmopolitan, free, global citizens.
Et alors, dans les années 90, donc il y a cette explosion comme ça du spam, et donc ça, évidemment, c'est l'explosion aussi des spammers. Et ce que vous décrivez dans votre livre, c'est un monde, alors, qui est un peu l'opposé du monde des hackers, au sens où c'est vraiment un monde de médiocrité, d'avocats véreux, d'escrocs à la petite semaine. Enfin, il n'y a absolument rien de ce panache, même dans la criminalité des hackers. Et alors, donc je suis un peu curieuse sur ce monde des spammeurs. Est-ce que vous avez pu parler avec certains? Est-ce que vous avez même cherché? À quoi ça ressemble ce monde-là? Et puis, du coup, évidemment, la question qui se pose immédiatement, c'est à quoi ça sert? Je veux dire, qui clique sur ces spams?
Spammers, at first, did it because, well, they still do it, although the underlying structure has changed, as we can discuss. But they became who they were, they became spammers, because it was, in fact, for quite a long time, a very good way to make money. It was not great money, but it was good money, sometimes excellent money, and you could make it fairly easily without having to put yourself in too much danger. This leads to a crucial point about the community of spammers and the things that I observed about them prior to the moment when spamming becomes a truly criminal enterprise and starts to be run largely by powerful criminal gangs, which happens in the early 2000s. Prior to that, though, in the boom years between 95 and 2003, it's a space for entrepreneurs who are willing to plunge into a new market that asks very little of them. It does not ask cleverness. It does not ask for some kind of brilliant business breakthrough. It doesn't even really ask for hard work, but it asks for personalities who can absorb just limitless amounts of hatred and loathing and bad will. And it ultimately becomes rather tragic. And I did, in fact, speak to and communicate with a handful of people who had been spammers. But I ultimately didn't draw on that too much because, as you can imagine, the people who have been spammers who are willing to talk about it are a very unique sample of the overall community of spammers and unrepresentative in many ways. But looking at legal filings, at police documents, and at also the sort of amateur surveillance being done by anti-spammers who were keeping track of all their activities, reading about all of these people in detail, ultimately, many of them become quite tragic figures. Many of what these early spammers were doing, these entrepreneurial spammers, and many of the people who sort of invented the field, was that they were actually just, and this is kind of one of the other answers to why did they do it, is that they were really just importing an already existing set of shady, problematic business practices from the analog domain into the digital domain. There had already been communities of people who had done direct mail and automatic telephone solicitation, people who used to run ads for, dubious supplements in the back pages of weightlifting magazines, people who advertised phone sex lines, people who engaged in all kinds of small-scale scams and cons. They now suddenly had a new venue in which to work. And it's sort of fascinating to see how many, like, very common, say 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, sort of classic cons suddenly turn up in this electronic format.
Troisième acte, vous avez un peu évoqué le moment où ça, le spam entre de plein pied dans des activités criminelles de plus grande échelle. Qu'est-ce qui se passe au début des années 2000 qui lance la troisième mutation du spam?
So spam transforms in a very profound way around 2002, 2003, and I really see 2003 as being the crucial hinge year in which it becomes much more like the system that we know today, this kind of encompassing, global, highly criminal architecture that wields an actually extraordinary amount of power behind the scenes. Now, what happens that creates all of this, that leads to this transformation, is that for 8 years, give or take, spamming had been able to sort of live in the shadow of advertising. So it was very difficult for legislators to create laws that could completely outlaw or seriously penalize spam without threatening the possibility of things like advertising online or sending advertising by email and so on. So those ads, those laws were often fought by companies that had an interest in this space. So spam could sort of shelter in this ambiguous gray area for quite some time. In 2003, a series all over the world, a series of major laws, some laws go into effect and other laws start to be enforced much more seriously. People like, just in thinking of the United States, Elliot Spitzer, for example, who was then a district attorney who later went on to have a huge, giant scandal that, you know, derailed his career. He launched an aggressive campaign in which he was going after individual spammers. And these were significant, large-scale spammers. And he was going to send them to jail. He was going to bankrupt them. Like, this is suddenly, this changes the game a lot if you can no longer just sort of skate by on, you know, you're on your reputation as an entrepreneur exploring a new market space, and instead you're criminalized. So that's one aspect. Now, the way that these laws manifested themselves, the way that they struck the balance, and this becomes very important, the way they struck the balance between spam and advertising was to say, all right, to send these messages, so we don't prevent all advertising, to send these messages, we ask that you include all these various kinds of official text. You must make it clear who you are sending this from, on whose behalf, where people can write to unsubscribe, and so on. So there's this specific legal language. And here's where the really important matter comes in. Because the other thing that's happening around 2003 is that a series of innovations are finally coming to fruition around building superior electronic filtering systems for being able to identify and block or discard spam messages. And those systems thrive on language. They identify language that is a significant sign of spamming happening. And what that means is that spammers who want to follow the rules and to include all of this language and legitimize their messages are also adding exactly the thing that the filters will identify and perfectly stop 100% of the time. So, all at once, spamming is illegal, and also the rates of success for messages, including somewhat illegitimate messages, drop spectacularly. So this should be the end of spam, right? This should be, you know, the moment when the whole industry just rolls up and goes away. And it's what many people were expecting. But instead, spammers, those who remain, adopt a whole new family of technologies and techniques to advance their message. The spammers who survive this kind of, we can almost think of it as being like, you know, the end of the dinosaurs, you know, the spammers who sort of thrive like mammals in the aftermath of the situation, they do a couple of things very differently. First of all, they move away from what we might think of as somewhat legitimate, but also much lower profit enterprises, such as actually trying to sell, you know, dead stock toys or fake watches or all the various things, you know, pornography, all the various things that these earlier spammers had tried to sell. They move away from that and into the space of outright crime, credit card fraud, getting logins and passwords, selling potentially things like illegal drugs. Pharmaceuticals is still sort of a real business, but a lot more of it becomes about defrauding people directly or getting much larger sums of money out of them in various ways. So suddenly, you can make a lot more money for each message that actually gets through. But that still doesn't address the problem of how many of your messages are being blocked. So what you need to do is develop a system that can let you send many, many more messages than you ever have before. And that is the system called the botnet. And the botnet becomes the thing that makes spam into what it is now, into a point where it actually becomes something more like a military weapon.
Qu'est-ce que c'est un botnet?
A botnet is... Perhaps the best way to describe it would be to just describe what the infection is like, because that's very relatable, and then you can sort of see it scale up from there. So a very common kind of message that one sometimes receives is an email from, let's say, a friend or a coworker that says something like, hey, could you take a look at the attached document? And then there's a document there, and you download it, and you launch it, and it either doesn't open, or it gives you some kind of weird error message. What you've actually done is launched an infection on your machine. And that message was, in fact, sent by your friend's infected machine. And what this infection does, it doesn't look like anything, but instead, quietly, behind the scenes, it takes over your computer, and it begins to use your computer's, like, always-on connection to the internet to download instructions from a remote server somewhere else in the world, and then to start acting on those instructions. And what often happens is that those instructions are, start sending spam. Here's a list of addresses. Here's some text to use in messages. Also, while you're at it, scrub the computer that you've just taken over for other addresses to send this infection message to, as well as other things that might be useful, like passwords or private information or secret business documents or things of that nature. Now, when your computer downloads those instructions, when it gets taken over, it's called a bot, and it has joined a much larger system called a botnet. That means that your machine, along with thousands, tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands or even millions of other computers, are all, without appearing to belong to anyone but you, without appearing to have changed in any way, except perhaps being a little slowed down, all of those computers can be under the control of a single person or a single team of people. And a desktop PC sitting in an office somewhere on a normal broadband connection can send upwards of 150 or 200 spam messages a minute, minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day. So abruptly, spam moves from a business where it's all about trying to, like, get a good deal with your ISP so that you can send a few hundred thousand messages. Spam suddenly moves into a space where you can move quite literally a billion messages, billions and billions of messages every single day at no cost to yourself if you run this botnet. So there is the answer to the problem of filtering. Instead, you can actually just deluge the system with messages, and you can build really, in some cases, if I may say so, quite ingenious programs to do things like varying each message by a matter of a few words, so every single one is distinct, which makes them much harder to filter once it's identified one as spam. In this way, you can essentially overcome all of this infrastructure. You can build an ocean so that a very small trickle of actual spam will get through.
Alors justement pour la question du phishing, donc ces emails qui cherchent à récupérer vos données bancaires, vos données privées, est-ce que vous pouvez nous raconter qu'est-ce qui se passe une fois que ces données ont été collectées? C'est-à-dire quelle est l'économie souterraine dont ces données sont la matière première?
One of the most painful things about learning about phishing data and how it gets circulated through this underground economy of spammers and identity thieves and other criminals is precisely how little it's worth. That it's, and I say that as painful because, you know, you think of, oh my God, my identity has been stolen. It's this personal tragedy. But in fact, what's going to happen once you have, you know, fallen for one of these messages, which is easy to do as they become more and more convincing, or once your computer has been compromised by a piece of spam sent malware and has been now like scrubbed and scraped for all kinds of personal and significant information that have been sent along, is that it's instantly packaged. It's bundled together with thousands of other people, which are then sold in blocks. So when you look at these marketplaces, and I have looked at some of them, they're fascinating environments. Many of them take place in an archaic online chat system called IRC, Internet Relay Chat. It's just text, it's just, you know, people like writing text in real time, and the text is incredibly straightforward. It says, I have 3,000 credit card numbers, and I've tested, let's say, a certain randomly chosen percentage of them to verify that they're all good, and I will send you some information to show you that, like, you know, because you can sort of ping things to get limits for various amounts and so on, I will show you that you can really cash these out. And then you give me some percentage of what you think you're going to get by actually cashing all of them. Or here's a whole lot of information for, let's say, Australians or Germans or, you know, Russians or US citizens that someone who is actually in that country can use to do an identity theft project for those people. So what it actually happens is that your data enters a strange kind of economy, because it's one thing to steal your data. It's unfortunately, in fact, really, really easy to steal people's data, but it's quite another to actually make real money from it. So one of the business models is to get this data and then sell it on to people who have many different roles like cashiers, as it's called in the trade, who can specialize in the skills that are needed to actually call a bank and pretend to be someone, which of course means you have to be the same gender as the name on the account. You have to speak the same language or have an appropriate accent and various things of that nature to not invoke suspicion. Or people who have the kinds of relationships where they can, let us say, do a small-scale identity theft, enough to buy, say, one big-screen television, and then do it several hundred times, and then have the connections that they need to fence all those televisions and actually realize the cash on what they've done. So your data kind of comes into this extraordinary community of people. I don't mean to sound so positive about it, but this extraordinary community of people who specialize in turning that data into money.
Et comme vous avez dit plus tôt que maintenant, il y a effectivement moins d'acteurs dans le spam, mais qu'il s'agit d'acteurs plus puissants. Est-ce que c'est à ce type d'économie que vous pensiez ou est-ce que c'est d'autres types d'actions qui peuvent être aussi entreprises maintenant avec les botnets?
The people who actually run global spam at this point, especially if we're talking about email, some other kinds of spam that are contemporary now, like spam on Twitter and Facebook and search engine spamming and so on, those things are a little bit more disparate and distributed. But the people who run email spam, who are responsible for this daily global spam load of these tens and tens of billions of messages, hundreds of billions of messages, this is actually a tiny group. Estimates vary, of course, especially as people are arrested and as new people enter the field. But the vast majority of global spam is produced by probably about 200 to 300 people, by very, very small gangs who have access to these vast botnet resources. And then they are surrounded by a somewhat larger community of people who can actually, who can specialize in the various aspects of identity theft, credit card fraud, and things of that nature as a business. But given how vast their impact is, it's very hard to think of anything else in the world where such an enormous industry is produced by such a tiny group of people, who nonetheless remain quite hard to actually catch.
Vous avez aussi mentionné la militarisation du spam, c'est-à-dire donc l'usage de spam à des fins militaires, ce qui est quand même extrêmement surprenant, parce qu'une fois de plus, on est très très loin de l'email sur, enfin de voilà, des emails qui peuplent nos corbeilles de mails. Alors, est-ce que vous nous expliquez de quoi il s'agit, quel type d'usage, et est-ce que du coup, le spam est devenu une forme d'arme mercenaire que des acteurs puissants peuvent engager pour mener diverses campagnes?
Spam has become militarized in a couple of different senses. Once you have something at this scale of the kinds of botnets that we have been describing, which I can mention, we've talked about the billions of messages, but I can mention in terms of scale that botnets actually reflect the rotation of the Earth. They're so large that in the scope of their networks, because of course computers will go off the botnet and then return as people turn off the power and then turn them on again. So when night comes and people are powering down machines in their offices and going home or closing the laptop or what have you, those you can actually see the rise and fall in the capacity of the network. These are global machines. Now that means two things. The first is these global machines have access to all of these individual computers in essentially at this point every country in the world. Wherever computers are, there's at least a handful of them that have been infected. Many of them have been infected in environments where people have access to classified information. And what that has started to lead to is a genuine problem with spying that is based around exfiltrating pre-existing data. Like, so rather than saying, we want to do espionage on such and such a company, or we want to do espionage on such and such a country, you can instead get in touch with someone who has a very large botnet, and you can say, what computers have you compromised within this IP address range, which makes, you know, which only exists at such and such a company or such and such a government institution? And then just, I will pay you for all of the information that you scrape off of those, everything you've already gathered that you don't even know what to do with, all these gigabytes of data. So that's one, which is this kind of strange meeting point between the criminals and the spies. But the other, and in some ways more serious, is what's called a denial of service attack. When you have all of these computers, you can command them remotely to begin to, say, request a particular website over and over again, just as they would if, you know, an everyday user typed in the address or clicked on the link to receive that web page. And if enough of the computers are doing this enough of the time, you can make that web page essentially unavailable for everyone else who would like to access it. You can knock them offline. And we've seen that happen in a number of different communities. But one way to understand how to actually make money at this is extortion. So if you run an online casino, you know, and you have thousands of patrons who are all online gambling addicts and who are giving you a great deal of money, all of a sudden, none of them can get access to your site. You know, many of them are perhaps going to other places to gamble, and perhaps they're furious because they had bets going and now they can't see what's happening. They don't know if you're ripping them off. And then you get an email from someone who says, hey, sorry about your site being offline, and wouldn't it be terrible if that happened for, let's say, 5 days? You already saw the harm that happened with 45 minutes. But if you give us $50,000, you know, then we can make sure that your site is always up. And that's the kind of thing you can actually do with botnets. And you can take that kind of attack and you can scale it up to nations. You can scale it up to both military and civilian infrastructure. There's more and more methods in place to try to mitigate these attacks, but they're still a genuine problem. And they're a way in which spam has actually been turned into a weapon.
Pour parler aussi donc de l'automation du spam qui est donc à la racine de ce phénomène des botnets, vous parlez également de toute une zone un peu grise, un peu limitrophe qui existe dans le spam contemporain, qui est la zone donc de ce que vous appelez le journalisme algorithmique, mais aussi les sites de content farm, c'est-à-dire ferme de contenu littéralement, et aussi linkbait, c'est-à-dire des sites qui proposent des articles dont le seul, qui sont des espèces d'agrégats de diverses informations ou de headlines, de gros titres complètement, qui sont vraiment conçus pour faire cliquer les utilisateurs. Et alors que ça, qu'est-ce que ça veut dire? Est-ce que ça veut dire que le spam aujourd'hui, étant donné l'économie d'attention sur laquelle fonctionne Internet, devient de plus en plus indiscernable de toute une autre série de types de contenus qui sont vraiment du surplus, vraiment du junk. Et le deuxième point aussi que vous soulevez, c'est le rôle que joue le spam dans la définition de ce qui appartient aux robots et de ce qui appartient aux humains, puisque les filtres anti-spam sont perpétuellement améliorés pour justement faire cette distinction même entre ce qui est du robot et ce qui est de l'humain. En quoi le spam fait bouger cette ligne?
So here is a sort of question, or we could even think of it as like a koan, if we wanted to, which is,
okay.
Oh, a koan, like the Japanese Zen practice. Yeah, like sort of a riddle, which is if a message or a comment is actually useful to someone, is it spam? If they find value in it, even if it was produced by a spammer using some wholly automatic system, does it still qualify as spam? Now, the reason why this becomes pertinent is that, so we've been talking about a world that most people are kind of fairly familiar with, which is getting spam email. And spam email is so often obvious as such, you know? It's something that has an ad in it for a pharmaceutical, or it's something that is like a poorly spelled, you know, statement from your classic Nigerian prince, or whatever. But there is also a whole other world of spam, which many of us encounter in one way or another, often in fairly small ways, which is spam that is meant to manipulate search engines. So the goal here is to produce web pages, comments on blogs and wikis, to produce tweets, to produce all kinds of different things which can include links. And those links can either make money themselves by tricking someone into clicking them, which then leads to a page full of advertising or one which infects your computer, or through using all of those links to essentially fool Google's system into thinking that something is more important than it is. So if someone is looking for, let us say, mortgages, they will be led to your page before they are led to someone else's page, and you have various ways to profit from that. So where this becomes especially important and especially interesting is that to generate all of these comments, to generate all of these sort of fake web pages and posts and so on, it is, you have to have pretty good text. You have to have text that seems fairly human. So a fascinating evolution has begun to happen between people who are trying to generate that text algorithmically, which has been getting better and better, and between people who are generating that text by using humans in huge numbers. So the latter is where we begin to see models like a company called Demand Media, which is behind many websites that a lot of us end up viewing almost every day, who just hire freelancers to generate articles in batches of hundreds on essentially topics that reflect keywords that are going to be important. And part of the argument they make is that, well, we aren't really spammers because we have humans writing these articles, and the articles are about things that people are already looking for. How could you be more legitimate than that? But it does seem to occupy an interesting kind of blurry space with more outright criminal actors who in fact have automated systems that will look at those same keywords and then scrape the web for text. A program will sling it together into some kind of, you know, goulash of language and then post it. But even those, as they get better, are getting harder and harder to distinguish from the human text. I genuinely, as much as horrifying as it can be sometimes, it genuinely delights me to see that this extraordinary progress is being made in new forms of textuality that are coming out of, you know, trying to take over all of the search returns for people who are looking for deodorant reviews. The space of what I think of as this kind of accidental machine poetry is so rich and so strange that I would have to say that that part of the pleasure that I find in it and part of the interest that I find in it is not even necessarily in any specific instance of this kind of what came to be called a lot in English language anti-spamming, lit spam, this kind of strange literary spam that would assemble public domain texts into these collages. It was the fact that it had a very specific kind of logic which was so fundamentally alien. So it did not feel, to the point of L'autre amant, it did not feel like surrealist automatic writing. It did not feel like, you know, the work of like Robert Desnoyers with the sort of like dreamlike style of association. It did not feel like the cut-ups of William S. Burroughs. Instead, it actually felt very much, you could sort of sense the algorithm at work, because it was not choosing things randomly, the way Tristan Tzara would pick words out of a hat. And it was not choosing things according to like subconscious human associations, but instead it was choosing things by weighing different probabilities against each other, by modeling which words were significant in terms of how the machine was looking at the chances that they would be read in certain ways. And what this ultimately produces is an effect that I find very difficult to describe, but which feels somehow closer to like changing channels on a television than to following the sort of leaps of different kinds of human thought. And the encounter and the way in which we can begin to sort of infer a kind of unthinking yet quite compelling machine literary process, I think that is a space for both practical but also for like artistic and aesthetic investigation in the 21st century. I think there's actually quite deep and beautiful things there in this encounter with alien language.
Quelles sont les tendances les plus actuelles du spam, ce qu'on peut observer en ce moment, et qu'est-ce que ça nous dit de la direction que prend Internet?
The forms of spam that to me seem indicative of the future of the Internet are the forms that are now thriving on contemporary social networks. So we're talking about things like Twitter spam, Facebook spam posts, and then one form that is related to those, and this can be very, very quickly summarized. But the reason those two first forms that I described, Twitter and Facebook spam, are important is that many of those accounts, those spam accounts, are not there to send advertising messages to you. They aren't there to sort of try to fake you out. Some of them are, a few of them are, but many of them exist so that they can be rented out to users who want to suddenly have a huge number of followers or a huge amount of likes. So Twitter actually has a fairly large portion of its user base. Estimates vary, but quite a large, like not a non-insignificant number, potentially more than 20%, that are entirely bot accounts. These are non-human accounts that are there so that, and you will sometimes see these advertisements, so that you can pay someone, let us say, $100, and in return, suddenly you have 10,000 followers. You look very important. You look enormously significant. Now, the reason why this seems futuristic is that these are systems that are already manifestations, crude manifestations, of a world in which a major part of the audience for almost anything we do is not humans but machines. Machines parsing our activities, machines analyzing what we're up to, machines contributing to the social impact of what we engage in.
Alors, un point aussi que je voudrais quand même aborder avant qu'on finisse, c'est la question du rôle des métaphores dont vous parlez assez comme un fil rouge dans le livre. C'est cette idée que les métaphores ne sont pas juste une fleur de rhétorique pour décrire quelque chose, mais qu'elles ont, notamment dans le cas d'Internet, de vrais effets, puisque la façon dont on va conceptualiser par une image un phénomène, ici le spam, va aussi déterminer les façons dont on va s'y attaquer, les lois qui vont l'encadrer, les dispositifs qui vont aussi s'y attaquer. Alors, quelles ont été les difficultés majeures pour décrire par des métaphores le spam et À votre avis, quelles sont les métaphores les plus adaptées?
Metaphors are one of the most crucial ways that we can deal with new technologies, but they also carry this kind of inherent force. They end up helping us, in the process of trying to help us get to grips with things, they also shape how we decide how we are going to kind of implement those things. So, you know, it's one thing to say like, well, an MP3 is just sort of like a digital version of a cassette tape, which is at once sort of true and also profoundly not true in terms of how MP3s can be copied and remixed and circulated and so on. So with spam, in this case, you can see many of these early projects to try to describe what it's like. It's like direct mailing. It's like getting an unsolicited telephone call. It's like being forced to look at a billboard as it goes by. It's like people shouting in your conversation. It's all of these different sort of attempts to articulate what's happening here. And as I describe in the book in some detail, in various ways, all of those were incredibly inadequate for actually getting to grips with what was happening. And for me, ultimately, I think the most useful metaphor for thinking about spam is that spam in all of its various forms is a conversation, not between you and the spammer, but between you and other people on the internet about what it is that we need to exclude from the system, what it is that we need to stop, where we need to draw certain lines in order to make the system more valuable, more meaningful for all of us. Spam is, in an indirect way, a political argument.
Et avant de conclure, dans votre livre, quand même, il est perceptible que vous aimez, il y a quelque chose que vous aimez bien dans le spam, ça vous fait rire, ça vous touche. Quel est votre spam préféré? Quel est celui qui vous a le plus fait rire ou plus?
It's never a good idea to write a book about something that you just hate. After a certain point, you have to learn to not love it, but just kind of have a weird sort of respect for it, because otherwise, you know, like mere dislike is not an interesting perspective. So I did develop a weird kind of fondness for especially the more inventive kinds of spam. So one that always kind of charmed me with its insight into human psychology is actually a fairly rare form of spam, which was the private detective message. So this is a spam message that you would receive. There were a series of kind of outbreaks of this, some in the United States, a few actually in Southeast Asia. You would receive a message with an attached sound file, an attached MP3 file, or, you know, some kind of digital sound. And the message would purport to come from a private detective who had been hired by someone else in your life to investigate you. And he is found things out about you, but he's willing to make a deal with you to not reveal these things. And the proof that he has been spying on you is the attached sound file, which is a recording, a tapped recording of one of your telephone calls. And then the idea is that you download it, and it's actually a file that infects your computer and does all the malware things that we have talked about. But what I found, like, at once horrible but kind of marvelous about this is that it was also a very effective kind of spam message, because it played on the fact that, apparently, everyone or most people have enough secrets in their lives that they would be willing to believe that someone else had hired a detective to investigate them, that they had enough things to hide. And it reminded me of one of my favorite little jokes in literary history, which was the claim that Arthur Conan Doyle once made, that he could send a telegram to the 10 most respected, powerful people in London saying, "Flee at once, all is discovered." And he would send all of them fleeing out into the night. So I just love that along with playing on, you know, greed and lust and all of these other similar human frailties, there's something in spam that only works because it finds an echo in us, our sense of our own fallible lives.